You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
He is a graduate of Harvard Law School. Right now, he's a partner at WilmerHale and leads the venture group there. Just learned that whereas most law firms, including WilmerHale as a whole, have slowed down in their activities in general and their hiring in particular, the venture group is going great guns and desperately needs more lawyers. Curious and impressive. So John advises many startups. In his list of past clients, there are some very impressive folks, including Akamai, one of the less successful of his clients is Noank Media, which grew out of work here. So he's seen these businesses fly or not fly, and has over the years accumulated a lot of wisdom about what's likely to increase or decrease their chances of success. And that's what he's going to talk about here. All right, so John's going to start by talking for a bit, and then we'll have our usual discussion. It being hot out, the windows are open, and there's a little background noise. So this may will certainly mean that everybody's going to have to speak up when we have a discussion. If you can't hear at any point, you know, wait. John.
Right, thank you. So I've been a lawyer for 22 years. About 10 years ago, I left my Boston office at WilmerHale and opened a little office in Waltham that has 10 or 11 lawyers in it. We're all corporate lawyers, and our mission there is to help startups. So all we represent are entrepreneurs and startup companies in that office. And prior actually setting up that office, that's all I did was startups. So as you know, I incorporated Akamai Technologies, helped it raise all its money, did its IPO, and I've done that for hundreds and hundreds of companies over the last 22 years. I don't represent investment bankers. I don't represent VCs. I only represent those companies. I'm a West Pointer, so I'm kind of rigid. So I can't on a Thursday represent a VC and then on a Friday represent an entrepreneur against that VC. So I sort of have a unique model. My clients this year will raise over $500 million of venture capital money. So I keep I pay a lot of attention to what the VCs are doing, who's investing, what they're investing in. And so my whole life is very focused on, my goal is to help find hot startups and help them become very big. There were two IPOs in 2009. One was A123, which was my client that I incorporated and brought all the way through the IPO process. It's a lithium ion battery company. Another one is LogMeIn. I'm working on the Zipcar IPO. So I'm in the middle of startups. I have today hundreds of startup companies. Some of the Harvard-based ones, there are many, but some that sort of come to mind are a company called Gold Pocket, another one, and several spin-offs from Gold Pocket. Another one was Tickle, which started off as Meat Tails or something like that. And they were all, those were great outcomes for the entrepreneurs that started them. And a third one is Claros, it's a diagnostic company, which also came out of Harvard. I have a ton of clients out of MIT. They're sort of, you know, they're, as you know, very entrepreneurial, and sort of they make a lot of startup companies, and I probably working with 15 or 20 professors there who are starting companies. So my bias is on the side of the entrepreneur, and everything I say is designed to help those entrepreneurs make all the right choices. There's many choices they make, legal choices they make along the way, and my bias is to help them make the right choices so that they can grow and pay my bills. And become very big companies, create jobs, and all that other stuff. So I'm going to quickly go through the slides, you know, acts and omissions. Often I come to a client when it's already incorporated, and I sort of do a quick analysis, and I have to understand the issues, and then we try to we try to get them on track. So how do they become successful? They have a company that investors want to invest in. They have a company where the management team and the people who work there are properly motivated and all the interests are aligned. And you know, I'm setting aside whether they have a good idea or not. I'm really focusing on sort of the legal issues that I keep running into. So I am going to go quickly because we're going to spend as much time on any of these topics that you want to as far as discussion. Another error is pre-incorporation management of intellectual property. So especially in a university environment and business competitions, people get together, they have ideas, they share everything. It's collegial. You're in an academic institution, but nobody thinks about who owns the IP. And then all of a sudden they come up with a great idea and they want to start a company. And if the whole team is intact, all those people who contributed to the intellectual property, it's not a problem. If it's not intact and someone is off who got discarded from the group, it could become a significant problem, and it has to be resolved right away. You won't get any real money from a sophisticated investor until they know who owns the IP, who contributed to the core product. You know, there are plenty of fixes, taking that code out, or you know, making yourself very comfortable that the contribution from Terry before he quit the team is no longer part of the IP. Very hard to do. And a lot of the money, the smart VCs will say, go get a release from Terry. And that's really hard to do because all of a sudden he's been kicked off the team or he's left the team, he's not happy, and all of a sudden you come hat in hand looking for a release. So it's a problem to avoid, and it's easy to avoid. Form of entity. So there are all sorts of, you could take a whole course on what type of entity should I be. And in my view, there really is only one state to be incorporated in, and that's Delaware. And you really should be a corporation. When someone comes to me as a mass LLC or a mass corporation and they won't change, I won't take them as a client. I told you I was rigid. It's because they will eventually change and they will spend tens of thousands of dollars with problems in the meantime. Massachusetts is totally sort of broken as a set of laws for having a corporation. And part of the problem is, you can't, when someone asks me a question as a lawyer, my clients don't, they don't want, you know, what the left hand and the right hand, they want to be told what to do. And in Delaware, I can tell them what to do because the law is very settled. All the textbooks are written about the Delaware law. I can predict with relative certainty how a judge is going to come out. You can't in Massachusetts. So probably going to get in trouble for that one. So you should be a Delaware C Corp right off the bat. A lot of people say, well, I want to be an S Corp. I want to flow it through. Again, probably not. You can do it, and I'm happy to do it, but you're probably wasting time and accounting fees and money and... At the end, you're limited in the type of stockholders, and eventually you will become a C Corp. Timing of the issuance of equity. You know, I was on the phone coming in talking to one of my companies, and it's a team, and they haven't figured out how to split the equity, which we'll talk about. And before you can issue the equity, you have to split it. But they haven't issued it yet. And they're getting a term sheet that values the company at several million dollars, and they're going to get it in the next week or two. Creating a corporation early in the process is a really good idea. It costs very little to do. There's virtually no legal fees involved because with my clients, I say, look, if you never raise money, I never get paid. So let's get it all done. Let's do it right. And when you raise money, then I get paid. You don't raise money, I made a bad investment. So you really should incorporate the company early on. It forces you to make decisions. It forces the entrepreneurs to decide what the equity split is. It's really convenient for creating invention assignment agreements to gather the intellectual property in one place so that everybody who's working on it can sign an agreement, an NDA, with that company, or they can sign an agreement that say, look, I'm working on the company. I'm not getting paid anything, but I'm working on the company, and any IP I create belongs to this company. So there's many reasons why you should incorporate early on, and there's almost no reasons why you shouldn't. Few hundred dollars in out-of-pocket fees that you have to pay to the state of Delaware, not to Massachusetts. So you need to issue equity early on. Why? My client that I was sort of gently unhappy with on the way over here,
wants to now issue 3 million shares. Well, 6 months ago, he could have issued those 3 million shares for $3,000, and he could have paid full fair value for those shares, started his long-term capital gain holding period, and had a basis of $3,000 in the shares. And he owns them. Today, those shares aren't worth a tenth of a cent anymore. They're worth, he has a term sheet, or he's about to get a term sheet that says the company's worth $10 million. He can't buy those shares. If he pays a penny for those shares, they're probably worth 50 cents or 25 cents. So he has all sorts of income. Not a good idea. We have ways of solving the problems, but it's not without risk. But more importantly, he's got a team, and he's got this team that's hovering around, and now he can't give them restricted stock. He's got to give them options because they don't have the money to pay 50 cents a share. And if he just gave them the shares, if he gives a million shares and they're worth 50 cents, that person has $500,000 of income. So all of this could have been avoided if they created the company and issued the shares when it cost nothing or next to nothing. Am I going too fast? Is this making sense for all you? Okay. Equity split. So when I meet with teams, and I meet with them all the time, I have a computer science degree, I have an MBA, but I have a psychology degree, which is the degree I use the most. I really work with my founding teams, and we'll sit at the table. It's kind of like a therapy session, and I'm deciding whether how much of my firm's time and money and my time and money I'm going to invest in this company. So when there's six of them sitting around the table, and this was actually six guys from Harvard about 5 years ago, and they said, we're going to split the equity six ways. And I said, well, you need to go back and figure it out. And if you come back with six ways, you're going to have to, a six-way split, you're going to have to find another lawyer because I'm not going to do it. Because we'll spend so much time and energy solving all the bickering and mediating and doing family counseling, and I'm not going to do it. Because it almost never works out. And I think there's a professor here at the business school who's, I think his work is equity splits among founders. And I'm guessing he will agree with me. He does research. I do empirical evidence and my experience. But it almost never works out when it's an equal split. No one's bringing this. Six people are not bringing six equal contributions to the table. There's always half of those people saying, boy, I'm getting a good deal. And the other half saying, boy, I'm getting screwed. And that eventually will become a problem. Early on, when you're competing for 50K, it's not a big deal. But when the company, like Akamai, became a $35 billion company, that's the problem. Now, one might think there's plenty to go around. It doesn't work that way. It becomes a problem. And VCs sniff that out, and they will force that. They won't make a big issue out of it. They'll still make the investment, but it is a problem. It will continue to be a problem. You could chew up a lot of bandwidth and a lot of legal fees solving that problem later. So it really makes sense to fix that now. Now, have I seen three-way splits work? Yes. More often than not, they don't, but I have seen plenty. And two founders, 50-50 works really well. You know, Akamai was 50-50 right down the middle, and they did everything lockstep, and it solved. They had lots of issues, but they had no issues around founders' equity. Another, I'm reading my slides, and I'm not just putting this equity split. Okay, here we go. Most of the equity needs to come to work every day early on. So there's a professor at MIT who really smart, starts a lot of companies, and he's the only guy I know of who can take a lot of equity and the company's still going to succeed. In almost every other instance, when there is a founder who isn't working every day and owns a significant chunk of equity, the company does not succeed. So I have lots of ideas in why that might not succeed, but if you're the founder coming in every day, taking out the garbage, working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and every dollar you make, somebody who's showing up, calling in on Saturdays for a few minutes is getting 50 cents, it doesn't work. And those companies can raise money, but ultimately there'll be a recap, and there'll be a lot of time and energy and angst spent on trying to correct the discrepancy in the equity. VCs, the worst, the VC will never invest in a entrepreneurial founder who's been very successful, starts another company, but isn't going to work every day. but and owns more than 20% of the company. They won't invest in it, in my experience, just because it will lead to problems, personnel problems ultimately, and the team isn't focused on, you know, you work really hard, and the team's not focused because it doesn't feel like there's a fair equity split. I mean, I can look at a capitalization table and understand who's coming to work, where the who owns the stock, and what the next round of financing is going to look like, whether it's going to be a cram down or whether the company's not going to succeed. It really, you can learn a lot by studying, you know, maybe like in a forensic account, just look at a cap table, and you can learn a lot about what the next steps are as far as raising money and how that company's going to get restructured. Okay. Vesting provisions are critical, and a lot of lawyers will tell you something differently because it's really unpopular what I say to my founders. What I say to them is your shares have to vest over time. And again, my bias is I want the company to succeed. Your shares vest over time. Does everybody understand vesting? So you join a company and you get, what's your name?
Dan
joins a company, he gets 1 million shares of stock. And he comes in early, and the company was incorporated early, and he gets to buy those shares for $1,000. So now he's thinking, boy, if we go public, 1 million shares, $30 a share, I'll be building a building for Harvard. But he has to earn those shares. They have to vest. Now, he owns them. He paid for them, and he's starting his long-term capital gain for tax purposes, his one-year period, which today is a big difference between that and ordinary income. But if he leaves the company, the company has the right to repurchase the unvested shares. Typical vesting is over 4 years. After the first year, 25% of the shares vest. So if Dan stays a year and a day and then walks away, he gets to keep 25% of the shares because he earned them. Now, he's getting paid, out in the market, he could get $200,000 a year, but he's getting paid $60,000. But he's doing it not for the cash, but he's doing it for the equity. After the first year, that's called cliff vesting. For the next 3 years, it vests quarterly. So 12 quarterly installments. And there's many, many ways to vest. That's standard. Where all the discussion comes in, what about acceleration of vesting? Acceleration is speed up the vesting. So Dan thinks, well, look, I walked away from the McKinsey job. I came here. And if you fire me, I should get fully vested, 100% vested, 100% acceleration. If you fire me without cause, I'm working really hard. I'm a smart guy. If you fire me without cause, I should get fully vested. A lot of entrepreneurs believe that. Or if we have a change in control, I want 100% acceleration. So someone comes in and buys the company, I want 100% acceleration. I die 100%. I get handicapped or incapacitated and I can't come to work anymore. I want some acceleration, whether it's 1 year, 2 year, or 100%. All of those are really, really bad ideas. They're not uncommon. Most of my clients don't have them. 95% do not have them, but they're not uncommon. It creates all the wrong incentives for Dan. So the right vesting should be, in my mind, again, this is all my views, and I told you about all my biases. No acceleration. When you leave the company for any reason, whether you get fired for cause or whether you get fired without cause, your vesting stops. And the company can decide whether to buy back your shares or not, give you a tenth of a cent. If the company's doing well, they'll almost certainly buy back your shares. The only acceleration which I find acceptable is what's called double trigger acceleration. If the company is sold and then you lose your job, then you can have all your shares. So if the company sold and they say to Dan, we need you to move to California, he can quit and get all his shares. Or they say, you know what, we're cutting your pay from 40 to 30, he can quit and get all his shares. But if they say, we want you to work in the same job, he's got to stay if he wants to continue to vest. And if you sell the company, you know, I sold my client Equalogic for $1.5 billion in cash. The people who were invested, they didn't go anywhere. They stayed, and they wanted to vest. So why is that important? Many reasons. If you're going to sell the company, so first of all, as a founder, you need to set the example. And it's really powerful. You say, hey, these are the terms I have. These are the terms everybody has in the company. I have no acceleration except upon a double trigger. Because you hire really smart engineers, MIT engineers who've been there before, they know that it's better to get acceleration if you get fired than not. So if you, it's going back to Dan again, if Dan, after a year and a half, decides he doesn't like coming here to work every day, he doesn't believe in the vision, okay? He has other opportunities. He now has an incentive to get fired without cause. And let me tell you, it is because if he gets fired without cause, he gets all his shares, or he gets a year's worth. That's why you don't want to give it to him. He has an incentive. The right thing to do is pack up your bags and leave and go start your next company. But now he has an incentive. And let me tell you, it is you, any one of you people, because I listen to who you are, you can get yourself fired without cause in a startup company in about 2 weeks if you put your mind to it. The slower ones, it takes you 3 weeks. It's very, very easy to get fired without cause. And what you don't want, and from the management point of view, if you're the guy doing the firing, you don't want to have to gin up an idea to say, I have to fire Dan for cause because we need that equity back. And I already told you how bad it is for the cap table if too much equity walks out the door. Okay, that's one reason. And I have hundreds of examples. And if we weren't being webcast, I'd be going through a bunch of them. I would tell the CEO, I said, don't hire the guy. And he, you know, this guy wanted, if you fired me without cause, I'd get full acceleration. Don't hire him. And it went on months and months. I said, don't hire him. He hired him, fired him 3 months later. The guy sold his stock at the wrong time for the company, but at the right time for him, you know, made like $30 million or something like that. One thing, if you take a job like mine and you advise, never say, I told you so. It's not good long term. So another reason is you're selling the company. So the buyer, so Dan's stayed at the company. He's there. He's an early guy. He's there 4 years. Company's doing really well. Guess what you do right before you sell a company for $1 billion? You ramp up and you hire a lot of people, okay? So you're ramping up. You're hiring a lot of people. You're creating a lot of attention. And the buyers come in and they start bidding. And I've sold billions of dollars worth of companies over the years. Mostly I'm selling. A lot of my clients buy, but I mostly am on the sell side. And the biz dev guys in these large companies, Google, Microsoft, IBM, they're very smart. And one of the first things they ask for is, what are the option plans? What does the team have? Do they get acceleration upon a change of control? So they have $300 million to spend for Dan's company, but they're buying Dan's company and they're buying the whole team. They're just not buying the technology. And if everybody gets acceleration upon a change of control, They still have $300 million to spend, but they're only spending $240 million for the company, and they're keeping $60 million to re-incent the team because everyone's made so much money. And that $60 million could go to you because you're fully vested, could go to the VCs, and the VCs are aware of this. They don't make a big issue out of it. Many of them actually don't understand it. But more money ends up in the pockets of the early people. And, you know, people that you hire right at the very end, it's a windfall for them if they get single trigger acceleration. So I could go on, and I'm going to get in trouble if I spend too much time on this, but you can tell vesting provisions can screw up companies. Really bad preferred stock terms. One of my rules, I have a couple of theorems, or I forget what they call them, but the longer an executive spends negotiating his package, the shorter his tenure will be at the company. It's true 99% of the time. So the really confident entrepreneurs come in, give me the documents, they sign them. They don't ever think they're going to get fired without cause, because they never do. And they just sign and they succeed. And they, you know, George Conrades came into Akamai, just signed whatever was put in front of him. Still there. It truly is. And I've trained all my associates and I've told them over the years, I said, you're still negotiating those documents for that VP of marketing or that CEO, it is a theorem, is that the right thing? A law. It's not a law. The longer they spend, the longer they spend negotiating, the shorter their tenure at the company will be. And it's because they've been there before and they've been ousted before and they weren't happy with their package. So, really bad preferred stock terms. There is a correlation between bad preferred stock terms and the size of the investor. Now, there are really good small investors, but the general rule is the slower on the food chain, the longer the term sheet, the more cumbersome the terms are, the much harder it is to close, and it's much more difficult to raise money in later rounds. So the best thing, is in my view, is to raise money from the bluest chip, highest tier VC you can find. Those term sheets are 2 or 3 pages. They're very confident they get done in a week. You know, my legal fees on a Series A from a top tier VC fund is $20,000. A smaller third tier, second or third tier VC fund where they're, I call them engineers of the term sheet, you can go months and months and months. The money is small, the valuations are bad, and the terms are really bad. So what are bad terms? So I was on the phone last night at 9 o'clock till 10:30 with a company that took money, really nice company, but they took money from a very small fund that has since run out of money and isn't able to continue to put money in. So the terms are a cumulative 10% dividend, compounding cumulative 10% dividend. So every year, the $4 million grows by 10% compounding on the liquidation preference. Participating preferred, do you guys know what participating preferred is? Okay, so two types of stock in a Delaware C Corp, common and preferred. Investors, VCs always buy preferred. And the regular good type of preferred is they pay $4 million for their stock and they get, say, 30% of the company. When they sell the company, they have a choice. Get their $4 million back, their liquidation preference, or convert it to common and get 30% of the proceeds. So that is straight convertible preferred stock. That totally aligns management and the investors. So Dan has a share of common stock. If he does his job right and the slope goes like this, when they sell the company, all his preferred stock investors, his VCs, will convert to common, and Dan's shares that he paid a penny for will have the exact same value as the shares that the VCs paid $8 for, $7 for. You know, I sold for A123. We were selling straight convertible preferred stock with a $1 billion pre-money valuation before we went public to people lining up to buy it. And everybody was aligned. Now, where it doesn't get aligned is when it's participating preferred, where the VC doesn't have to make a decision. They get their money back, and then they get 30%. So they get their $4 million back, and then they get 30%. So it's not aligned. And when it takes a long time to get the job done and you have to raise $70, $80 million and it's compounding at 10% a year, before long, management, they're not stupid. They're not playing anymore because they know their common stock is so far underwater that if you sell the company for $80 million, every penny goes to the venture capitalists because they're going to take their liquidation preference. If you sold it for $120 million, they're taking 80, and then they're taking 90% of the remaining 40 if they have participating preferred. And if it's growing by 10% a year, before long, management doesn't want to come to work anymore. They're not stupid. They look at the cap. Your team will look at the capitalization table and sort of understand what is the exit strategy. So you really want to spend a lot of time thinking about your preferred. You're much better taking a lower valuation with better terms, which will align interest going forward. When you have companies that have a lot of overhang, meaning there's a lot of liquidation preference that has to be paid first, often the VCs and the board members will create management carve-out plans. So a management carve-out plan says, when we sell the company, we're going to reserve $2 million for Dan. Okay, you can just start checking off the months before that company is sold. Dan's now sole motivation, there's no more equity play for him. His sole motivation is to sell it for whatever he can and get his $2 million management carve-out plan for his team and get out of there and get on to the next thing. Happens every time. I go to these board meetings and I say, guys, you're better off restructuring the stock and aligning management with you on the equity. Because if you put this in, they have no incentive. And who runs these companies? The team that comes in every day runs these companies. They decide, it's up to how much work they put in determines whether that company goes public, becomes a multi-billion dollar company, or way off here, management carve-out plans, or it gets sold for $30 million and 28 goes to the VCs and 2 million goes to Dan. All right, now I'm not going to talk about that because I probably went over my time. And I realized that was very fast and very biased. but I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Yes.
Keen on the six-way split. Is that just because the number is too large? You like two, you like three, but six is too large, or you didn't like the that it was evenly split among six. You'd rather see like a 20, 20, 10, 10, 10, 10, or something.
So I want a split that reflects what contributions people are bringing to the table and are expected to bring going forward.
So they need to suss that out and argue about it at the start, even if need be.
Now, right. Not after we do all the documents and then we start amending them and then buying them back and then somebody quits and then there's a lawsuit. Or someone gets fired. See, you never want to create incentives at the very beginning to fire somebody to get their stock back. It just doesn't, it's a waste of human energy. So I am virtually certain when six people come in who are not clones and they say we're splitting it six, maybe I didn't say six equal ways, it's not going to work. The company may succeed ultimately, but it's going to be after a lot of pain. And I just like happy clients. So I don't take them. Yes.
So what do you think of students who are founders?
I love them.
Yeah, so you think?
I mean, Danny Lewin was the founder of Akamai, was a PhD student. I have three students right now who've dropped out of MIT, and I'm like, they're like 19, and I'm telling them you got to finish, but.
One other question. Do you have any thoughts about the events depicted in The Social Network?
I didn't. I got a phone call. I went to, some of those guys are Phillips Academy. Right?
Yeah.
So I went to Phillips Academy, so I got a phone call asking if I could get involved. And you know my bias is I don't do family counseling or disputes. I like going up like this and building companies. Now, if my clients have problems, I help solve them. I don't run away, but I don't walk into problems. So there are other people, litigators, do that. Yes?
Talk about the pros and cons at the early stages of issuing convertible notes.
So convertible notes, best thing in the world, right? So that's not a problem. That's why I didn't talk about it. But if you're starting a company and you can get people to give you a convertible note, which says something like this, you know, I'm starting a company. I don't know what the value is. I don't want to value it. But you're an angel, and you want to give me $100,000, I'll take your $100,000. I'm not going to negotiate a 10-page term sheet and do a round of preferred stock over $100,000, because preferred stock, you know, a preferred stock deal, the number of pages is this thick, the binder. So for $100,000, people do it, but it's the best way to take that money is a note that says, look, I'm borrowing this money, it's due in 12 months, and when I do a Series A preferred stock financing with an institutional investor, it automatically converts into that Series A preferred stock at a 20-25% discount. So Greylock comes in and is paying $1 a share, and your 100,000 bridge note, you get to buy those same shares for 80 cents a share. You get the same terms that Greylock has. I don't have to talk to you. I just take your money, and then I give you your preferred stock. And I don't have to negotiate. I don't have to value the company when you put that money in. So it's great for the entrepreneurs. It's really smart angels, in my view. You know, there's a HBS professor who does it all the time. And I remember as a young associate, I'd be working on these deals. I'd sell these companies. And there was this guy's name who kept showing up. And he'd get $80,000, $300,000, $600,000. I said, who is this guy? He's an HBS professor who just did these convertible bridge loans, and then they get rolled into the Series A, and he knew how to pick them. So that's the best way to raise money. Now, the angels say, well, wait a minute, I want to give you $100,000 so that you can use my money, create more value, so that when you do value the company, use my money to get a much higher valuation. And the answer is yes, because if you don't, there's no way you get to invest in this company. You're not going to be, it's the only way you get a seat at the table. The successful entrepreneurs are really confident in what they're doing. They work all day long. They track me down whenever I try to take a day off. They call all hours of the night, but they never stop. And they're really confident. And if you lack that, and it's really easy to raise money if you've got half a brain and you're really confident and you have a good idea. So that's the best way to raise money, convertible bridge loans. If you raise too much, then you've scared away the VCs. And if you raise too much and you've run out of time, it comes due, and that's a problem. Yes, back there.
Okay. Everything you've said talks to companies that intend to raise venture capital and eventually get acquired to go public.
That's correct.
Awful lot of companies have no intent to do either. Professional service firms come to mind. And do you have, where the seed funding comes from the founders, and the intent is to build an entity that is going to live a long time under the ownership of the founders. Do you have anything, any recommendations about structuring that kind of business?
So what I tell my clients is, I'll tell you what to do when I'm comfortable, confident. I don't represent those type of companies, and so I don't. You know, they can be LLCs, they could be mass family companies. I don't get involved with them, so I'm not an expert on them. So you're right. It's all raising money to go public or to get bought. Now, sometimes they turn into cash cows and people just sit there, but they have no need or use for me. They invite me to board meetings. That's rare, actually.
Is there a difference between East and West Coast VCs? What's the difference between here and Sand Hill Road?
So my clients are all over. I have several in California, a lot in New York. I'm actually becoming a fashion expert. I have a lot of fashion clients. A recent HBS one is Rent the Runway, which were two women from HBS came. And, you know, it was kind of they can rent dresses, right? Netflix for dresses. So I introduced them to all their VCs. I believe I taught them what preferred stock was, but I probably wouldn't say that in front of them. They raised like $20 million before they even launched. Well, they raised some with Bain, and then they raised another 15 or so with Highland. 6 months after graduation. So that was a company that would not have got, people in Boston wouldn't have invested in that company a year ago. In California, I sent them out to California, introduced them to Benchmark and a bunch of other VCs, and they were chomping at the bit to put money in. But Bain had the hometown advantage. And the guy, the VC at Bain, never left their side. He just was there every day. And they finally just said, all right, we'll take your money. But I believe they're willing to throw more money at sort of new ideas on the West Coast than here. That's sort of the lore if you read about it. My clients, I mean, they raise lots of money, and most of it is from right around here. So, but if you read the papers and you follow the lore, it's easier out there. Terms are different, and there's a lot of angels running around with terms that I don't, you know, I challenge you to put together a list of angel-backed companies that where the angels had a prominent role, where they were giant, you know, widely successful. I just don't think there's a long list. So, but they're a little looser with the money out there. Yes.
So it's great to hear that you guys are hiring so aggressively now, and hopefully that'll be the case, you know, several years from now when most of the first-year students here graduate. Can you tell us what you would be looking for someone to join your group, or kind of how we should design our curriculum to kind of be prepared to work in this field?
So the best course I took at Harvard was negotiation. So, and then I became a teaching assistant for Professor Fisher. So that was, that my client said, boy, you're so smart. And I say, not really, we're just talking about alternatives, you know? And that was probably so if you could take negotiation, that's, in my experience, that was the one it's the only thing kind of I remember. You know, I never used evidence or torts or anything like that. But negotiation is, because it's all day long, it's all I do is negotiate with my clients, and I prep my clients for negotiating with VCs and then with the IBMs and Microsofts and Yahoos when they come and buy them. So, and with, you know, they negotiate with the investment bankers, they really think you're smart when you talk to them. You don't use the word BATNA because it's kind of, it's one of the lingo, it's too lingo. But you just say, what are your alternatives? If you don't get this deal, what are you going to do? I don't know. I said, well, why don't you spend a few minutes thinking about it and call me back tomorrow and tell me what you're going to do? So negotiation was the, and then you got to take corporations. and you got to go, got to be entrepreneurial and practical. If you're one of those people who, like, you know, your goal is to get on the law review, you're probably not going to be a, you're probably not going to be comfortable in doing what I do. Because we tell people what to do. We don't really worry about the 17 different ways you could do it. And I've never footnoted anything since I graduated from law school. That's probably not very helpful, but. But there are firms, large national firms, who are coming to Boston because this is a great place to practice corporate law. They are trying very hard to get established here. Right here.
You haven't said much about the IP, so is it a prerequisite if they come to you, they've already locked up the IP issues, and would you even entertain a client that maybe has a good idea for a company, but the IP is a little pokey, or there may not be any at this point?
Well, part of my evaluation is, you know, what are the barriers to entry? Again, I'm making an investment of my firm's time and money. So what is the barriers to entry? If the IP is all locked up, that's a good thing. But, you know, you can never be sure. So I'll send them to my patent lawyers and I'll say, what do you think about this IP? But many of them have, well, you know, this was in the lab at MIT and we're going to start this company. And I said, okay, you know, you got to go deal with the licensing people and get the licensing. And, you know, VCs will often condition the investment on the getting the license done. MIT is, you know, I've dealt with lots of schools, but MIT really has it down. They're very smart. Half the buildings around the campus are coming from people who, so they figured that out. And so it's really easy to get the IP out of the labs, and it pays dividends for me and for MIT. Okay, back there.
Instead of asking a question from the perspective of an engineer who worked for 4 years for a startup company, my stocks were all vested after that time, so I thought I would, if the company was successful, I would have some of the rewards. But when the company was eventually sold, all the money went in terms of to the VCs or in terms of management carve-outs, and I've just wondered if I were ever to, you know, invest my time and effort working for a startup company again, would there be anything I could ask for to protect myself from that situation, or is that just the risk of
choose wisely? Choose wisely, and if you don't believe in it, get out. Just leave. Go to the next one. So, I mean, if I was representing that company and you came in to try to get some guaranteed payback, I'd be saying, jettison this guy. You know, why do you need him so much that we're going to change the whole sort of structure? There's no guarantee. Work hard, make it successful, or choose wisely. It's really trite, but there's not a better answer than that. So.
How does a cash-strapped startup afford a big firm, well, that hasn't gotten any VC money yet, afford sort of a big firm lawyer like you?
I'm free.
So what is your business model for dealing with startups?
So I talk to them sometimes for a long time, and sometimes I'll help them, you know, look at their business plan, understand their, make sure, first of all, I'll make sure they're incorporated and the IP is sound. If you came to me and said, I'm going to keep the IP over here and I'm going to license it in, you know, I solve those problems. All the IP has to be in the company. You can't, the only person who can license it in is MIT. That's it. There's nobody else, or Harvard. But founders can't license in IP. It never works. I'll work with them, and the more I spend time with them and the sort of, if they're repeat entrepreneurs, I have many, many repeat. They sell a company for $300 million, they show up and they want to start the next one. That's easy. I do that one. I send them the bill every month. I don't get paid until they raise money. Most of them raise, 90% of them raise money, over 90%. So if they're abusive, I call them up and I say, no, I'm not filing 15 patents. You know, it's just general maintenance stuff to keep you on the right track until you raise money. So if you want me to file a patent, then, you know, pay $1,000 and we'll file the patent. But people stopped taking advantage of me about 15 years ago.
Have you seen startups benefit from having lawyers in-house early?
Not really. I mean, I'm usually the guy that says you need to hire in-house counsel. But that's not a startup. That's sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. Companies going public, you know, I say we've got to get an in-house counsel. So I get a lot of lawyers' jobs in my companies. In fact, I was talking to one today. I try to limit it to HLS grads. Just kidding. Anything else? Yes.
You said early on that you don't like when founders don't work at the company. What do you do with founders who bring in capital? So they're essentially like a mix between an early partner and a family from VC.
So occasionally, not so much recently, but occasionally I'll have three founders and it's a third, a third, a third, and these two guys are just out of business school, or one was in a lab getting his doctorate for many years. And then the third, I said, what do you do? He goes, oh, I gave him $50,000. Well, that doesn't work. That's just like the professor who's not the famous professor who's holding too much equity outside. So that doesn't work. Putting in $30,000, that's capital and it's needed, but it's not worth 20% of the company. You would never do that deal. So if they put in $30,000 and they're working every day, then that works. But $30,000 and they're sitting watching, it doesn't work.
Can you structure that $30,000 as a convertible note?
Yeah, that'd be great. But no equity until it gets priced when the Series A gets priced. And you can give, there's lots of, you can give him a consulting agreement where he vests in some 5% of the stock over 2 years, as long as he's contributing and working. So it's not as, you don't see that so much anymore. So, as a lawyer, which many of you will become, I often say, will you take equity? I always get the question, will you take equity? And, sure, it sounds like a good idea, but I've never taken it. In fact, I was instrumental in my firm adopting a policy that the lawyers who work on these companies should not take equity in the company. So equity for services for the firm, right? Or, there are a lot of lawyers who will personally invest. $50,000, I was talking to a guy yesterday. He says, I put $25,000 in every one of my startups. And I did some rough math, and I thought, boy, you have a lot of money. And it could be because he's done this, right? But I won't do it. I think it creates the wrong perspective, and I think it compromises my ability to give what I think is the right legal advice. Now, that being said, my firm has a fund where all the partners, so my share in a $50,000 investment is about $8.30, has a fund where if the VCs are comfortable, we'll put in $50,000. Because there's a lot of partners, this was our compromise. A lot of partners in the old days used to put their money in, and it creates enormous conflicts within a law firm and appearances of sort of conflict, some real, some imagined. But so we'll put in $50,000 as long as $4 or $5 million is raised. So it's no one will ever question whether John's giving, if you sell the company now, I can pay for 2 years of college and buy a new car. I never want that to be a question on the table. So the West Coast is very different. It's freewheeling. They write checks all over the place. And if you think about it inside a firm, there's 100 lawyers in my corporate department just in Boston. And we compete for a resource called the associates, called what you guys are going to be if you join a large law firm. And so Dan's really smart. And so I'm going to monopolize his time and put him on all the companies that I've put $50,000 in. And when it comes time for the bill, I'm going to write off more time on my company because I'm invested in it and I want them to succeed. So it's just not fair to a partnership. So you'll all be faced with that, and my advice would be do not make anybody quit and become a general counsel, but then you have to pick wisely. So I've been offered the general counsel lots of times. And most of the time, the right no was the right answer, but there were a couple when yes, I probably wouldn't be here right now.
So presumably many of the associates in your office do make this choice that they practice with you for a while, and then an especially attractive opportunity comes along and they veer off.
Yes, they do. Yep. Yeah. And then they're in my stable for the rest of their career, and I move them from company to company. I put the general counsel into A123 before it went public. I put it into Zipcar and I put it into LogMeIn. So all three companies that went public, and they're very wealthy.
So is the result that, aside from becoming very wealthy, they can benefit from a revolving door in which they become parts of the startups, and then when they are sold, they return to a general practice, and then
they almost never return to. So, and I've been studying that, and I'm thinking, if they never come back, they must really be happy having left. They don't even try to come back, as far as I know. So,
it's been bothering me because I get a little on. Maybe I should leave. It's hard. It's very hard work. Very hard work.
Which is what you do, or what they do?
Well, it's being in a. See, if you're in a company, you have one client. Well, you have several clients. You have VP of marketing, VP of sales, but you really have sort of one mission, and you focus on it. If you're, I'm a general practitioner, corporate lawyer. I have thousands of clients, and then I have to deal with my firm because I want to spend marketing dollars on this Harvard thing or this MIT thing. So it's a tough job. You really have to like it. And if you can focus, like I have, then it's the only way it's tolerable for me, because I love entrepreneurs, and I love watching these companies grow. And there's last night, I got off that 9 o'clock board call. Now, I don't do board calls every night. And I looked at my email, and I had 3 $20 million competing term sheets for a little company. So that makes me happy. So that's called alternatives. And leverage is the most important thing in a startup or in life. Got to have leverage.
So one more general question here is, law firms in general are still, most of them, climbing out of the financial crisis, including WilmerHale as a whole. But your description here and briefly beforehand suggests that the VC and startup market has recovered more quickly, and not quite so visibly, at least to a casual observer.
So I'm not studying the larger trends, but in my world, all of my lawyers are very busy, and all of my clients, are always raising money, and often with competing term sheets. It's as vibrant as it's ever been. So the period of time, the VCs will kick tires a little bit longer, unless they believe it's really hot. I see lots of VCs. They call me. What do you have? Can I come in and go over your startups? Can we talk about your startups? Which ones? You know what I'm interested in, John. I haven't heard from you. So there's more of that going on.
You're an effective broker.
Yes. Most of my clients, I introduce them to their VC. Unless they're repeat entrepreneurs, then they come to me with the term sheet and say, make sure I don't get screwed. And I remind them, I say, I don't represent you, I represent the company. But right now, you as a founder, your interests are totally aligned with the company. So at the end of the day, I report to the board. So I have, once in a while, I have to remind them of that. But there are large international law firms that are trying to get set up in Boston to do corporate technology law.
But incorporate in Delaware.
Yes. If you remember one thing, it's a Delaware corporation. Yes.
When one makes the rounds nowadays at a lot of business plan competitions, you start seeing a lot of social ventures. Social entrepreneurs seem to be on the rise. Can you give a little bit of your prognosis on how you see the funding community responding to this new trend in entrepreneurship? For instance, like you had mentioned, your business model for your firm relies on big deals down the line, perhaps. A lot of social ventures may not have those big deals. So
I call them app companies, right? I'm not interested in app companies, right? Because they don't need me. So I'm not interested in them for a reason, because they don't need me. They're not looking for me. There's a couple of people creating an app and selling it.
So a lot. Social networking is key. I have several. I told you I was becoming a fashion guy, which makes my wife crazy because I buy my shirts at Costco. But I have several fashion companies in New York, and a lot of them have a social network aspect to it. But it's a real business. It's Facebook taking the Facebook model and applying it to an industry. so that all the players in the industry are friends on Facebook, in effect. And a lot of interest in that among the VCs.
A bit more social enterprise. So, for instance, when you're seeing startups focusing on problems in the education space or
emerging
markets, these sorts of things.
I have a fair amount of clients like that. Yeah. There's a new thing is, I saw a headline today. It's called Stealth Health. So it's tricking all these games. Sorry. So how do you monetize all these games? Everyone's playing games, right? No one's going to admit it, especially not you guys. But how do you monetize that? And so a lot of them, and you know, you can make this sale to schools. A lot of these companies are saying, we're going to create games that will actually create better habits for eating habits for kids or exercise. So there's a lot that's going on in that arena, and there's a lot of interest by the VCs. Benchmark, this guy Bob Cagle did eBay. You know, they did eBay. They did all the big ones out there. They're very interested. So using the web to improve. As these guys get older and make billions, then they start worrying. They get to the generativity stage of their lives, and they start investing in companies that sort of do good. And so there's a fair amount of that going on. And if the ways to change behavior via the internet, someone's going to make a lot of money on that. I mean, it's happening now. Yes.
How does the VC's approach to a company and your approach to a company differ based on sort of the startup costs they need to get going? Like, I imagine Zipcar and Netflix, you can't really sort of start them overnight and raise venture later. So how does their approach and your approach differ for those kind of companies? And what do you advise somebody who is Netflix and comes to you and says, I can't do anything until I raise a ton of money?
Right. So, well, Rent the Runway raised $20 million before they found that money. It was relatively easy. It was two HBS grads who had some relevant industry experience, but they were young. But they created buzz, and they are confident. And people are betting on them. I mean, the thing, which I didn't say here, as I was looking at errors and omissions, right? The thing that the VCs invest in most is the team, the people. That's the most important thing of everything. It's the team, who it is. So Zipcar is an example of a company that is going to be wildly successful that got started by angels early on. It was an idea in Cambridge over here, and it started very, very slow. And then they raised a little bit of money from a little bit of angels, and then they said, you know, we need to upgrade. I don't know who that's the wrong word. We need to change our law firm. And so then I got hired. I didn't incorporate that one. I got hired, and I came in. And what we were able to do is, and they got a new CEO. He's been there 7 or 8 years now. And he came in right at the time I came in. And I said, we need to change these terms. We need to fix this cap table. And so we attracted very large blue chip VCs who put in a lot of money and said, conditioned on recapping the company and fixing. You know, no one lost any. Everyone's making a lot of money there, assuming it goes public. But fixing the terms, the early angel terms. So I would have taken that client because I liked the idea and I was confident. I would have been confident it would have raised money, but probably I would have tried to steer him away from angels. Whether that would be right or wrong, I don't know. But that is an example of a company that early on got the angel money. But then Greylock came in and Benchmark came in and wielded big paychecks to change things. Yes?
Two companies, Netflix and Zipcar, where I'd be hard-pressed to point to any intellectual property.
Yeah, there's less and less, in my practice, there's less and less IP, barriers to entry, IP being a barrier, less and less. It's all about execution, which leads, especially in the internet world, which really dictates raise a lot of money. When you raise money from the right VCs, you get, your customers are more confident that you're going to be there tomorrow. It's really easy to hire great people when you can say, you know, I took money from Matrix and Kleiner. And then you can execute. Then you can blow it out. So it's all about who. It's not the old land grab but it's about execution and being there. And the barriers to entry are really strong VCs and a great team. There's a lot. There's, you know, Rent the Runway. There's no IP there. It's all about execution. So we filed a couple of patents, but I'm sure. I told them to waste the money, but they do it anyways.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chilling and very interesting.